All right, let's dive into the latest Blu-rays.
Wait, Brian, does something feel different to you?
What do you mean?
I feel like this is a landmark moment. Like, we've come back from the brink of extinction, and things will never be the same.
You know what, Chris? I think you just might be right.
We're back.
Wait, what did you call me?
Chris. That's your name, right?
It is my name.
Don't go into the light.
Kunta Kinte. Your name is Toby.
But I...
What did I say? Your name is Toby.
Hey. I don't know. You referenced The Roots, and then we all tried real hard not to be racist.
No. I referenced Roots. If I'd referenced The Roots, I would have just called him Questlove.
All right, fair.
You are so far beyond my understanding right now. Can we please go back to referencing Star Trek and Buffy the Vampire Slayer?
Yeah. Well, hey, kids, guess what? This is the inaugural episode of Digital Noise on oneofus.net. Holy crap.
Welcome.
We've got a new show.
Same as the old show.
Pretty much. Not a lot is going to change. But, guys, I just want to say the outpouring of support for this new show and this new venture has been incredible, and we want to thank you. Also want to thank Aaron Jeffers for that awesome theme music.
How cool is that?
As well as Ryan Dunsmore for doing up our incredible logo art there, which I am very much a fan of as an 80s person. In fact, both the music and the logo art seem to have a very 80s vibe that I appreciate.
The only problem I had at all with that combo was after you see the logo, you're like, shouldn't we get Daft Punk to do this?
Yeah, because we can afford that. No, absolutely.
They're nice guys.
They'll do it for free.
Assuming they're guys. They might be Data. I don't know.
Well, I am Brian.
I am Christopher Lawrence Cox.
Apparently, his name is Christopher Lawrence Cox. Yeah.
And we're new, right?
Who knew?
Not me.
And of course, we've got our favorite ginger in the whole world back with us once again, Mr. Luke Mullen.
Hi.
Jeez. I feel I'm getting a little teary-eyed. The band's back together.
I know. We should all go to Las Vegas and plan on nothing going wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we are not in a tenuous position right now at all with the brand new site launching and everything's fine. Let's go to Vegas and not worry about things.
Put it all on red.
Put it all on red. I'm really excited. This is sort of our flagship show for the new site. This was kind of the inspiration for the site in general, was just having a new place to put this.
I know, we were just like built from, well, we gotta figure out somewhere else we're gonna take this, to like, let's build a whole fucking site!
Our eyes are a little bit bigger than our stomachs sometimes, and that doesn't just apply to Chinese buffets.
Or your sex habits.
Or our sex habits.
Okay, I'm distinctly uncomfortable. Beer, please!
Shoop! Here you go.
Really, that was quick. For you to get uncomfortable, not for the beer delivery.
No.
It might not have been coincidental.
Hmm.
I might have used it as an excuse for beer.
Hmm.
That's making me uncomfortable, Luke.
Okay.
Beer, please!
Well, thanks again for joining us in the first episode of Digital Noise. Don't try to reduce us. We're going to keep bringing you the Blu-rays and DVD reviews that you've come to know and love, as well as the terrible jokes and the beer swilling and all of the general crudeness. We're really not changing much in the way of formula here.
Except for this first episode, when, by nature, we don't have any viewer mail.
What?
No viewer mail. We should sing the song anyway.
Should we? Yeah. You think, just for old time's sake?
Just for old time's sake.
All right.
Viewer mail! Viewer mail! Viewer mail!
Except we're not going to call it viewer mail anymore.
Are we not?
All right. Well, maybe we will. Who knows?
But I don't know. I kind of like doing that. So.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll stick a pin in that for now. But yeah. The other thing that's...
That's Brian's way of saying mommy and daddy will fight off mic.
The other thing that's different about this show is, I don't know if you guys noticed, and actually I think you did, just by the freak and the geek out that a lot of you, that I appreciate, that you did on our Facebook page. Like, what the fuck is happening? Where are you going? This is a travesty! So you may have noticed we haven't been here for a while, but that means that we have a backlog of releases that we kind of need to dig into that we didn't get a chance to.
Yeah, now we're, of course, not going all the way back to the last episode because we, quite frankly, don't have all day to record an episode of Digital Noise. But
that's
that being
true.
Said, we're going to go about the last 3 weeks I guess 4 weeks by the time this comes out, and just go ahead and cover just some of the bigger releases, some of the more notable releases that we really wanted to talk about, that we're sad that we didn't get to talk about.
Sure, absolutely. The kind of things that you guys would comment and say, hey, why didn't you talk about this?
Well, so there you go.
Nipping that directly in the bud. And we're going to start, we're just going to dive right into this with Oz the Great and Powerful.
Almighty Oz. Luke needs, what does Luke need? I don't know. Luke, what would you need from the wizard?
I need Blogman's beard wax.
Blogman's beard wax. When you need to look like you're in the know about things no one needs to know about. Blogman's beard wax. Yeah, Oz the Great and Powerful, which first of all is not about...
Dorothy.
Seth Green's character in Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Don't give up. Keep going.
Yeah, I was like, Seth McSec... Buffy the Angel Slayer.
I'm proud of you that you got there, though.
I did. I managed to pull that out without actually... God damn it. I don't want there to be audio of me saying I managed to pull that out on the internet, because someone will remix that
there
shit.
There already is.
Yeah, oh, we'll remix it to It's Raining Man.
Yes, totally. So Oz the Great and Powerful is a movie from this year where Disney finally gets their chance to take a crack at a big studio-sized Return to Oz. Not unlike Return to Oz, which kind of blew up in their faces. This is more of the vision that Walt Disney had had long ago about the way he wanted his, you know, his Disney trek to Oz to look like. And we have James Franco playing the young wizard, and this is the story of how he got to Oz in the first place.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, like, the books these are based on, there's a huge amount of books, and not even just from the original author, L. Frank Baum. There are multiple people afterwards took it up and they're considered, for whatever it's worth, canon in the storyline. I mean, this Ozworld has a lot of big fans.
Yeah.
So the idea of, like, they're like, well, why wouldn't we make this into a bigger universe? It already is.
True story.
Was like, okay, I don't have a problem with that. A lot of people said, oh, prequel to Oz. I'm like, shut up. This is an exception to the rule. They're allowed to do that.
Sure.
And you know, I mean, I think it makes sense here, even though there was a lot of like cast changes with who was going to play Oz originally. I mean, like, I think it was Johnny Depp at one point and Robert Downey Jr. You know, coming down to James Franco certainly seems like you're getting, like, you know, decaffeinated coffee to some extent after right. those titles. But nonetheless, I think...
Poor guy.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I really like Franco, but, you know, he's not an A-list actor, let's face it. He's no Robert Downey Jr.
Not yet, but he's well on course to be one just by nature of the fact that he does, like, 15 movies a year.
That's true.
Eventually, you just won't have any choice but to have James Franco in your movie, because he'll already be there.
Yeah, exactly.
You'll be editing and be like, wait, when did we cast Franco?
I don't think we did the Franco edit of
Star Wars. He just showed up on set, and we were like, fuck it, roll camera.
You know, you're right, Chris, there'll be the edit of Star Wars, where instead of Ewoks, it's just little James Franco is all over Endor.
Okay, that's disturbing. Beer!
Beer!
but Franco actually does manage to pull it out, I think, on the whole in this film. Mm-hmm. Shit, now they're gonna use me in that song.
So far, the t-shirts are beer, !, and I managed to pull it out. So we're working on catchphrases now.
Oh, God, please help me. Assuming you're there. You know, I think ultimately he found the right note for this part. And in many ways, he and Raimi's sense of imagination are the saving graces of this film. Because the script is not terrific, but it manages to rise well above, like, similar Tim Burton fare, like Alice in Wonderland and that sort of thing.
Which is what I think we were all terrified this was going to be, just looking at the marketing, as we worried it was going to be another huge production that failed to capture the spirit and the magic of why we liked the original in the first place. And I think a lot of that magic is there. And one of the things I particularly like about this movie is that it weaves a lot of its references naturally into sort of the landscape of the movie. Like, I think my favorite is they're walking along and they're walking past a horse pen, and the horses of a different color are just wandering around. Nobody makes a mention of it. It's just there in the background. I'm like, okay, that's a cool reference. I like that.
Yeah, you know, a reference specifically to its own mythology. That's
absolutely.
Which is, you know, I mean, yeah, you shouldn't reference, like, other James Franco movies or something.
No, that'd no.
God, if there were Spring Breakers references in this, I would be so happy.
Look at all my emeralds! Don't be looking behind all my curtains!
Oh, my arm is trapped under this house!
Wow.
Wow, that's 127 hours in The Wizard of Oz is a mashup I never thought I would want to see. But
and
here
yet,
we are.
And you still don't.
I think if this movie has a weak link for me, unfortunately, it's Mila Kunis, which it makes me sad to say because I really like her as an actress. But she's just so, I don't know, she's so exaggerated in her role here. And I don't necessarily want to say, I mean, I'm pretty sure everyone already knows who she plays, but I don't really want to say it because it could be perceived as a spoiler. But
yeah, I will. I'll say I sat down having seen all of the marketing and everything, and I didn't know, and I was kind of surprised.
Okay, well then I'll leave that where it is. But suffice to say that I think she's a little bit cartoony with her role, which is sad because I don't think that was necessarily her choice.
Well, I agree, and they have a strange arc for her to play that maybe a better actress could have found something else inside of, some other better connection, but when it gets to that transfer point where she has to really in many ways become a completely different person,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't sell, it unfortunately. Doesn't.
And that's the big failing of the film is that that point doesn't sell.
Which, yeah, that point needs to sell. And the weirdest thing for me is when you first see her in this new role, you don't really see her, you just hear her from off screen.
Yeah.
And it's with such an overwrought intensity that I've heard her do as Meg Griffin on Family Guy, that I was like, oh, well, that's just Meg. They put Meg Griffin in the movie now.
That'd be pretty funny if everywhere she went, people were like commenting on how flat-chested she is and unattractive.
Shut up, Milo. Yeah, no, that
which is ridiculous because she's amazing. Oh,
she's gorgeous. Yeah,
so gorgeous.
She's absolutely gorgeous. I mean, I think another weak point is that I thought that some of the characters here felt like they should have had more to them. Like, I'm specifically thinking of Michelle Williams, who's Glinda, the Good Witch of the South, who's such a key part of the Oz mythology,
mm-hmm.
and really she feels very underplayed, underused here. Williams is playing it as if it was just a childlike memory of this beautiful princess queen from the original film without adding anything new to it, really.
Sure. Agreed. Yeah, she almost seems to stumble through the film like she's high.
Yeah.
Like, she's not really connected with anything, and as a result, she doesn't connect with the audience.
But Franco, as his anti-hero character, really does connect with the audience. And like I said, it's a big linchpin as to why this works. He's very funny. He's basically a con man who's eventually finding his own heart. And a lot of the new characters as well that are not in The Wizard of Oz are great. There's a thing with a porcelain doll character, mm-hmm. that's terrific and has great animation.
Yeah.
Really liked, good voice on that. The winged monkey in here, who's the good winged monkey.
Yeah, that's the thing, is they don't really address that as why there's two different species of winged monkey. One of them is, you know, in a little bellhop uniform and adorable, and the other is fucking terrifying.
Because the bellhop is the black one.
Was
that disturbing?
We're going to get letters. Beer!
Beer!
Hey, that's my line.
Nope, that is now a running joke.
And my
so
beer.
So wait, where do we all fall on this? Because personally, like, I think it's okay. I think it's fine. But if I had to be pressed on it, I would say more of it maybe doesn't work than does.
You mean
and
the movie
I feel like
as
you guys
whole?
Are kind of on the other side.
I think more of the movie works than doesn't. I just think that, unfortunately, the things that don't work are pretty major components.
Yeah, and part of the charm in this comes from the first viewing with the gee whiz of the very innovative and beautiful
the G-whiz.
Effects. Yeah, gee whiz. you know, I mean, it is beautiful. The designs for this are gorgeous. It actually looked terrific in 3D. It was one of those live-action films that the 3D in the theater, it's like, wow, this almost never happens anymore, but I'm impressed with what they're doing with this. Lots of neat visual stuff, but often stuff like that on the second time, it's just not enough to hold it together.
Mm-hmm.
Sure enough, I think once that you know, awe is over, you can see more of the holes in it. But that being said, you've still got the strength of Franco here, who does such a great job in an incredibly difficult part, considering he's largely working on CG sets with CG, you know, actors around him, you know.
Right.
It's like, hey, Liam Neeson, what the fuck? Franco did it just fine.
Franco did it. Yeah, and I overall, I think a lot of the movie works, and the things that don't are unfortunately just bigger parts of the movie than those that do. But I think if you average everything out, I think more of it works than doesn't. But I do think it's probably a movie for really diehard fans of the world of Oz more than somebody who is just sort of has a passive interest.
I would argue
in the original.
I would argue this is the film, though, that with younger kids might make them a diehard fan of the world of Oz.
That's true. Possibly. I wasn't even really thinking about children. I guess I'd with a movie like this, it's probably
what are children.
Yes, they're little humans with sticky hands.
Mm.
Yeah,
that's disturbing.
Trying to rid the world of those.
Well, this particular Blu-ray does have a. I will say the really interesting special feature on this Blu-ray is called Walt Disney and the Road to Oz. It's about 10 minutes long. It's in high def. It looks really beautiful. And it's the story of all of the different times that Walt Disney attempted to make a movie, like get the rights and then get a production together set in the world of Oz. And there's some really interesting stories. Like, there was a movie we actually covered on this different iteration of this show, called Babes in Toyland, which is Disney's first sort of live-action musical. And that movie only exists because they had started production on what was going to be a version of Oz, and when that fell through, they just kind of moved forward with it in a different universe. So it's just interesting to think, oh, well, that explains a lot. Like, Disney's obsession with the world of Oz and with L. Frank Baum's work explains a lot about what happened with Disney movies and Disney parks afterwards.
Yeah, it was his white whale.
Yeah, totally. Which is funny, because he has a giant whale in Pinocchio, but that's neither here nor there.
And its name in the script was Oz.
Its name in the script was Oz. So,
there's actually a decent amount of stuff on here. There's a lot of, like, you know, looking at the China Girl and how they did that as a combination of CG and on-set actual marionettes is kind of neat. There's lots of little neat stuff. I mean, if you're interested in the effects, a lot of this really focuses on that. But, I mean, it's got one of those second screen things where if you like the picture-in-picture. I never watched those things, I admit.
Yeah, I can't say I'm a huge fan either, but I like that it's there.
Yeah, because someday you might change your mind.
Exactly.
Yeah. And there's a strange sort of personal documentary called My Journey in Oz, where Franco is filming his fellow... It's the thing, is Franco is now so interested in filmmaking as well as being an actor that he's making movies while he's not making...
Whoa,
meta. Yeah, he's going super meta.
I think he... Doesn't he do that on every film he's done?
Does he really? I guess it depends on whether or not they end up putting it on the special features.
I'm just imagining that, but I could sworn that...
I assume that James Franco just walks around with a flip all of the time.
Yeah.
No matter what's happening.
That would make sense.
Totally.
All right. That was Oz. The prequel to the jail story.
Indeed. So Chris asked me what we were going to talk about next, and I said... Snitch?
Snitch is certainly kind of a movie.
You know, it's funny. I know I like this movie more than you guys did, probably even quite a bit. And that being said, even I wasn't that crazy about it. and part of the biggest reason for that for me here is that you've got Dwayne Johnson, who I'm a huge fan of. Like, straight up. I love Dwayne Johnson. I think he's got charisma coming out the
charismatic as fuck.
I think he doesn't even have muscles. It's just all the charisma bulging trying to get out of him because he's just that likable. But the problem is here is even though they're casting him as a good guy here, like that's forced into a uncomfortable, morally questionable part, they play the whole time as if he could get his ass beat by anybody.
Yeah, everyone's messing with him in a way that I'm like, you guys have eyes, right? You can see the person that you're threatening.
Who would even react to him the way that... I don't care how gangsta you are when The Rock walks up on you, especially nowadays. Like, back in the Rundown days, okay, he was a big guy, but he wasn't like, you know, oh, fuck, run for your lives.
Yeah.
And now it's like, wow, you're like Schwarzenegger and Conan big.
You're a bottle of creatine with legs.
Yeah. And there are points in here where... oddly enough, your suspension of disbelief cannot be suspended for that.
Mm.
But, you know, it's just, I think there's an awkwardness to them trying to give him this more dramatic role here that's not wonderfully well written.
It's really not. This movie bothered me. What really bothered me about this movie, and I'll admit, I've never been to law school, so I may be talking out of my ass.
Maybe.
But at every turn, it seemed like the legalese they were using to keep his son in jail was complete and utter bullshit.
Well, I mean, I think you were supposed to feel that they were intentionally manipulating the situation in order to make him do what they wanted, because it ends up with him basically volunteering to keep his son out of jail for a minor offense, all things considered, you know.
Right, but here's my problem. Like, I understand that there are bullshit laws. I get that. I totally do. Yeah. But what I don't understand is why... the U.S. government would spend time setting up and stinging this kid who, had they not set up that sting, wouldn't have done anything wrong in his entire life.
Well, they were probably hoping for something bigger.
That's the whole thing is like, it just, the word entrapment keeps coming up throughout the entire time I'm watching this movie. I'm like,
sure.
They couldn't do that. They couldn't do that.
Legally wise, there's a lot of questionable stuff in here, but even so... I mean, fuck, the government, especially when it comes to drug laws, nowadays, the way the laws have been restructured, they can do almost anything they want.
That's true.
Yeah, like, the thing about, like, first offense drug laws being super strict is definitely true. Like,
absolutely, just, that is.
It's ridiculous, but that's just the way our legal system is set up right now.
And like, they do things like try and get little fish in order to scare them into giving them the big fish to working for. I mean, that's actually... extremely normal to have happen. Now,
that, yeah, that entirely.
And as well as them playing the system and not being completely honest with the people about their legality, because a lot of times, you know, your little Joe, your average guy, he didn't have a lawyer of his own.
But that's the thing, is this character did have a lawyer, and a lawyer was like, well, there's nothing we can do. I'm like, then you never went to law school. There's no way there's nothing you can do.
He's Henry Winkler from Arrested Development, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. Jeff Winger on Community is a better lawyer than you are.
So Dwayne Johnson ends up volunteering to become like the undercover guy himself, even though he's just a truck driver. Or no, not even a truck driver. He's he owns a trucking company.
Yeah, he owns like a shipping company.
And yeah, the degree in which he gets into this, I mean, there's a point you're like, all right, so if you're just trying to make like a film that's a commentary on what's going on and with the drug laws and everything, okay, you probably should be a little more, like you said, like stick to what's real. Mm-hmm. But I can see that there's a good movie in there. And I can even see as like a being nervous about getting caught type of thing, the guy being forced undercover, there's a good movie in there, even though for that type of movie, Dwayne Johnson totally miscast for it. But then the fact at the end, it finally turns into a Dwayne Johnson action movie out of nowhere.
Yeah, and yet still, when it does that, the most active thing he does during that entire sequence is he sits in the cab of a truck.
Yeah, no, he doesn't even get to be a badass, really, except for running people over.
So there's a big action sequence.
I thought doesn't he have a shotgun? I haven't seen it since it came out
in theaters. Well, he does, but he doesn't get to use it in a sort of, like, look what a badass guy I am sort of.
I mean, he shoots cars. What are you guys looking for in this
An
movie?
An action where he doesn't spend the vast majority of the action sequences sitting in the cab of a truck.
Right, hiding in a cab in the truck.
I'm sure people will argue the same thing about Road Warrior, and then I will feel stupid.
Yeah, it's like, I was just thinking Fast and the Furious. Like, it's still an action movie. Like, I guess I'm confused.
Because, like, I don't know, to me it's like, why would you cast somebody as huge an action star and as physically huge a guy as The Rock and then be like,
and not let him get into fights of hand-to-hand combat situations?
Yeah, like, let him fucking kick someone's
ass.
Well,
I don't have a problem with, like I said, once again, giving the guy a chance to stretch his dramatic wings without it being a flat-out action film, but this film is just a little too schizophrenic about what it wants to be.
I would agree with that.
And I did like the action sequence at the end. It just didn't feel like it fit with the rest of the film, that's all.
Yeah. Man, I guess I liked it a lot more than you guys then. Chris, you were totally wrong. Like, I am the one that likes this movie. And I think it's just fine. I think it's perfectly fine. I think it's an acceptable action movie. I really like, you know, the guy that plays Shane from The Walking Dead, John Bernthal? I don't know how to pronounce that.
Yeah, actually.
But I thought his character was really interesting and dynamic and well-drawn, right. And I always love Michael K. Williams. I think he's amazing and just has
the one guy in the movie
presence
that's
unbelievable.
When he gets in The Rock's face, he's the one guy that I'm like, okay, yeah.
Yeah, Michael K. Williams does not give a fuck.
He's got a scar.
Did you see the scar on his face? He does not give. He has zero fucks to give.
You two. Never mind. All right.
Michael K. Williams is
But
badass,
see, I think I come in I come in between you two guys then, because I'm like,
don't say that either. They're going to remix that shit too. Damn it, Chris.
Do I have
That's
to,
all right. Tell us more about where you come,
Chris.
Do I
have to be the Oreo filling? no, I there was a lot of this I did like. I just, it kept, as soon as it would grab me, it would let me go again. You know what I mean? Like, they're a bit...
I guess, yeah. I mean, I don't disagree with the points that you're making. I was able to look past them and enjoy the film for what it was.
But to be, you know, for people looking for a Dwayne Johnson action film, this is not what
not,
you're looking for at all.
This is more if you like The Rock, but you've always wanted to see him in an after-school special.
Yeah.
This kind is of,
that's
yeah.
valid.
And a very
that's
expensive
valid
after-school special.
Yeah, one in which he inexplicably drives through Austin twice.
Yeah, that was weird, wasn't it?
Yeah, because he was like supposed to be going from like St. Louis to like Mexico, and it's like, why did you go through Austin?
Well, it was some weird route that it was like, do you realize how out of your way you would have had to have gone to actually
but
drive
But it's clearly, like, you can see Frost Bank Tower both times.
I guess they were, you know, like, I guess they were banking on not enough people knew what the Austin skyline looked like, so nobody would notice. But
it's so weird, because they had to, I assume they shot the rest of the movie in Louisiana, where most films are shot these days, and it's like, why did you drive over to Austin for like two shots?
It was on the road on the way to Louisiana.
I guess they're just like, fuck it,
just shoot out.
Pull over, let's get the camera out.
Wait, I know why. It's because Barry Pepper was going for the complete Willie Nelson transformation in this movie, so they went to the source. What the hell is up with his ponytail in this movie?
Yeah. I kind of love it. I kind of love everything about Barry Pepper in this movie.
Yeah, and this is, don't pick this up thinking you're going to get a lot in the way of special features. There's
they didn't bother.
What?
They didn't bother.
They didn't bother, no, not at all. There's one kind of long documentary about, or behind-the-scenes featurette about the making of the movie, and there is a commentary with Rick Romanois, who I don't find very interesting. And there's deleted scenes in the theatrical trailer. That's it. I mean, that's all you're getting. This is sort of a just slightly above bare bones Blu-ray.
Yep. Yeah. What you see is what you get.
Indeed.
No Easter eggs.
No Easter eggs for The Rock, who will be starring in Disney's The Easter Bunny next year. Probably. I don't know. That up. I may have made that
there
up.
There is actually an Easter horror film coming out next year.
Ooh.
With Robert Dazar.
The fucking maniac cop.
Yeah.
Ooh.
As the good guy.
Interesting. The guy whose face looks like a catcher's mitt.
Yeah.
I wish you guys could see Brian's boner now.
It's called Easter Sunday, and it's about a lunatic slasher killer who comes back from the dead. He's undead and puts on an Easter bunny outfit to kill people.
Nice.
Small town sheriff who ends up taking him on, played by Robert Dazar. My question is, like, wait, undead guy comes back on Easter Sunday, puts on an Easter bunny suit.
It's Jesus.
Totally
it's
Jesus. Jesus.
It's totally Jesus.
Oh my God. Worst like a spoiler ever. I'm sorry.
I think I'm going to go out on a limb and say it's probably going to be at least as scary as Night of the Lepus. Which is the other Easter horror
the
movie.
The only other one.
In that it's about giant killer bunnies!
I don't know if that... They don't even think they mention Easter in there.
No, but it's as close to an Easter horror movie as we have.
Yeah,
so, true. Congratulations, Robert Zadar. I can't wait to see you take on the Easter bunny.
Hooray. Christ.
We're going to move on from
literally.
There to something equally as big as my anticipation for this Easter bunny horror film, and that is Jack the Giant Slayer.
It's equally as big as your anticipation?
Well, there are giants in it, so...
That was a bit of a stretch.
I don't know where you were going.
Of course it was a stretch. Have you met me? Have you listened to me record shows before?
Hyperbole?
No, never.
No.
I was going to say, have you listened to this show before, but this is technically the first episode, so no.
You've sort of listened to it.
Sort of.
This is Aftermash.
This is the spinoff.
No, Jack the Giant Slayer is like another studio's, or is it another studio or the same studio? No, it's not Disney.
It's Warner Brothers.
Warner Brothers' attempt to do that sort of big tentpole like release that they're hoping that could spawn sequels and that sort of thing with lots of CG, a retake on a classic story, in this case being Jack and the Beanstalk.
Mm-hmm.
And this one, unlike Oz, really kind of falls flat on its big face.
On its giant fat face.
And a lot of the reason is that there's just not a wild amount of imagination here with the visuals that are created for it. I was surprised by how generally there's a lack of imagination throughout it with that sort of thing, and the CG is not even all that good.
The individual shots I actually thought were really spectacular. And in fact, I paused it to kind of look at the video quality, and I paused it on a scene of just a giant doing something, and I was like, wow, somebody really went to a lot of trouble to render every conceivable millimeter of that skin. And I was like, okay, it's highly detailed, but you're right. There's not a lot of imagination. Like the big battle at the end is basically just people throwing trees.
Yeah.
It's like, like that's it. That's all they can come up with.
Well, and even more so, like if you're going to do a film like this, it has to have a lot of camaraderie and just funny back and forth moments. And they try, God help them. They try.
Yeah.
But it's just not that funny. Most of it is actually downright kind of groanable, and it's not the fault of Nicholas Holt, who plays Jack. I think you can tell he wants to be a big star really bad.
And I think he was used, or he was really good in Warm Bodies.
I think
he's got a lot of charisma.
I really like Warm Bodies, actually. Yeah. I'm that guy. But
I like it too.
And About a Boy, which is where he largely got his start. He's
right.
Wonderful in that. But I think give him time, and he's probably going to be a bigger star. He might need a Twilight-type movie first, but,
And you can get that from the special features on his movies, which... Jack the Giant Slayer, just like Warm Bodies, he does a surprising amount of cursing in his blooper reels, and this
it's
one especially.
Fantastic.
And I'm like, that's hilarious, but this is, what was this, a PG-13 PG movie? And he's just like, dropping like great British curse words left and right.
Well,
I'm like,
you're hanging
wow.
around Ian McShane on set. You're like,
oh, that's
want
true.
To impress him,
Yeah, I'm surprised this movie wasn't called Jack the Cocksucker.
Now, Stanley Tucci here, unsurprisingly, is cast as kind of a wormy dude, the king's advisor, who is like, the giants aren't really even the villains. They're sort of just a force of nature, kind of, whereas Tucci really is the villain of the film.
Mm-hmm.
And that being said, he's a pretty lame villain, I thought. And I like Stanley Tucci, but the part they've written for him is not wildly,
there's
it's
nothing
not a stretch.
For him to
there's
do.
No, there's nothing for him to do. And they
give him a shitty sidekick.
And they,
oh my God,
and they
yeah.
write him out of the movie. When it's over, it's like just kind of like, well, you've had enough of that guy.
Yeah, it's like,
Oh, really?
And his character.
Or have you, says
oh my
the
God.
Finale.
The ending of this movie may be the most infuriating part of the whole affair. Just, you get to the end and it's like, did you really just try to half-assedly connect fairy tales to history?
Yeah.
Go yep. fuck yourself. I'm sorry.
And I will say, Ewan McGregor here, who plays Captain of the King's Guard, is one of those guys, like, he's got so much enthusiasm, he's so likable, you're like, why aren't you doing anything good with him? Why yeah. is he just, like, a side character here? He's, like, one of the most exciting people to watch in this film, and ultimately...
And he's still kind of a cartoon. Shrift.
Yeah, and he's still a cartoon. It's just a poorly written script is the biggest problem with this film, and I felt like when it actually went into production, the people who were in charge of, like, designing all the stuff that went with it weren't that excited about it either. And yeah. it shows. This isn't a terrible movie. It's just, I mean, it's the very definition of a rental. You know, you're like, eh, watch it at home. You'll be like, well, that was cute. And that's about it.
Something I found very strange with this film is that it tends to lean toward darker material, but then at the last second, recall that it's, oh, it's like, wait, we're not an R-rated movie, so we better cut away. And it's like, if you know you're going to have to cut away, why do you set it up to be that dark? You know what I mean? It's, unless you can follow through with it all the way, I don't understand why you would pursue
it. Lots of heads getting ripped off.
Yeah, there's a lot of, like, animals and people whose heads get bitten off, and it's, like, this really dramatic thing when they get picked up. It's like, oh my god, this is really dark, and then they cut away, and it's like, well, but then why did you...
But I kind of wanted to see that.
I don't know, it's not necessarily even that I wanted to see it, it made the movie feel like it couldn't decide how dark it wanted to be.
Oh, fair enough. Now, the bonus features here, there's also not really a hell of a lot. There's another one of those interactive feature that have behind-the-scene featurettes that pop up. There's about 8 minutes of deleted scenes and 3 minutes of gag reel, and that's all you get.
Yeah, they found a way to take all these little bits of EPK, or electronic press kit, and work it into a game. Like where you're
it's a climbing. Really stupid game.
It's really stupid.
Have you ever seen a game on one of these that wasn't a stupid game?
No. Nope.
It's just a way for them to go, well, we don't have much, so how do we package it in a way that makes it seem like a really great interactive effect? And it's like, this is the best they could do.
Yeah, meh.
And I also think this should have had a 7.1 mix on it. I mean, if any movie that we're going to talk about should have had a huge surround mix...
All right, Mr. Show-Off with the 7.1
yeah,
surround
7.1. System in his house. I'm just saying, it. What, Luke, you're looking at me funny.
Luke, did it have a 7.1
No, I checked.
Mix?
It okay. only had the 5.1.
Luke, you need to come over here and set up my surround system.
All right. Fair enough.
Luke does need to, and that goes for everybody. Just in general, as yeah. a rule, Luke needs to set up your
Luke
sound system.
Luke is looking for extra work. So give him a call. He'll show
sure,
up.
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
You might have to look at his butt crack for a while, but that's how it goes.
But it's a pretty butt crack.
Yeah, it's not so bad as butt cracks go.
Climbing down off of this beanstalk, let's go ahead and talk about 21 and Over, which I'm going to say this right now. I was terrified that this was going to be another Project X. I think I'm on record as being a sort of hater of Project X, and the trailers for this made me go, oh god, here we go again. I am happy to report that that is not what this movie is, thankfully.
Well, viewing from that coming from you and from Luke's cheerleader stance over here...
I love this movie.
We're not going to agree on 21 and Over.
And that's fine.
This, I felt, was even worse than Project X.
Oh, come on.
It just,
no,
wasn't, wow. It just wasn't funny. And that's the thing. A comedy has to be funny, and this is not funny.
See, I completely
I guess that's
disagree.
That subjective thing about comedy, because yeah. I laughed a lot.
Well,
movie.
We've talked about that a number of times. That's probably the most subjective genre in all of cinema is comedy, because what makes one person laugh, what makes another person laugh is completely subjective. But I found the banter between the two friend characters, not Jeff Chang.
Jeff Chang!
Jeff Chang, Jeff Chang.
We tried to keep a running track of how many times they say Jeff Chang.
I had intended to turn it into a drinking game
and
until
we
got
like,
to 50.
It was yeah, like, we were like 30 minutes in and it had already hit like 40 or 50.
It was like the Bill Murray scene in Coffee and Cigarettes.
It really was.
Yeah. What you doing at a coffee shop, Bill Murray?
Bill Murray. Bill Murray. But yeah, this is the story of two guys who go to a college and they're going to take their friend Jeff Chang out for
Jeff Chang.
his 21st birthday. This is, of course, the night before he has to have an interview with med school, which is funny because it's a very similar setup to Harold and Kumar. It's like you have this big meeting for med school tomorrow and your dad is very, is his taskmaster and he really wants you to go. And he's very
Asian.
Traditional. Yeah, well, okay.
Yeah, they make a, come on now, it's not me, it's the movie.
I didn't say anything.
Yeah, the movie is like, you know how Asians are. And you're like, come on, stop that shit.
So you have that setup going on. And then, of course, it leads to a night of debauchery. And just, to me, here's why to me this doesn't feel like Project X. Because Project X was just about seeing how much trouble these two people could intentionally cause and how much destruction they could intentionally cause. And them just being gleeful about bringing the world down around them and burning everything. And that's really not what... This movie feels more like... a film about one night trying to get home, something like After Hours, where it's like the whole movie is really just a setup about A lot of crazy shit happened. Now we're trying to get home. And a lot of the stuff that's happening is not necessarily... It's not their fault, but it's also like not like they're going out looking for something. Like, they weren't going out looking to, you know, release a bull.
Well, here's the difference to me between this and a movie like Project X. Just take the very first encounter that they have. They go to the first bar. They've had a few beers. They're not paying attention playing darts, and they accidentally throw a dart through a dude's cheek.
Yeah.
And they're very apologetic about it. They're not, you know, it's like, oh, shit, you know, I'm really sorry. You know, the guy overreacts, and they're like, well, you know, I don't know that we need to be throwing chairs about this, but, you know, but they're not, like, if it was Project X, they would have been, like, laughing.
They would have been filming
really
it. Oh, dude, check out what I just did to this guy's cheek!
And, like, Instagramming it or something, and I don't know. I feel like that's, like, the fundamental difference, is, like, these are some guys that just want to go out and have a good time. They're not trying to hurt anybody else.
It sounds like a nitpick, but it's not. It's what allows us to like the characters.
But I'm not willing to judge this film based entirely on its differences from Project
X. No,
that,
it's not about the differences from Project X. It's about why or why not you would like a character who is, you know, going through this particular... If you don't empathize with the characters, if you don't like the characters at all, then their entire journey through this night means nothing.
Yeah,
that's solely based on whether or not... For me, it's whether or not I think they're a total douchebag.
I just didn't identify with them because I didn't think they were very smart. I didn't think they gave them anything funny to do. And I didn't think they were total douchebags, but they certainly weren't what I would picture to be nice guys. I mean, they're pretty mean overall, except for when they're afraid they might get their asses kicked. I mean, they treat people, including Jeff Chang, like shit. I don't know. I
don't agree with that.
I didn't find them engaging or likable, and I thought that a lot of the stuff that happened was like, come on, really? Moments. I don't know. It just didn't do much for me. There are moments here and there that genuinely made me laugh, for sure. So, no, this is not a complete waste of time. But... Yeah, maybe I'm just too old for this shit now. I don't know.
You were too Murtaugh for it?
Yeah, right?
You went a little Murtaugh there.
I'm getting too old for this shit.
What's up, Jew?
I think for me, what made it work is I like the characters. I like the banter between Skylar Astin and Miles Teller.
I love Miles Teller. I'll watch Miles Teller in any movie ever.
One of those two guys was in Pitch Perfect last year, which is another movie that I surprisingly...
The other one, Skylar Astin.
Oh, he was... Okay. Skylar...
Miles Astin. Teller is Astin. The guy... Oh, Astin.
Yeah.
Miles Teller is the guy from...
No, he's not. He's not that guy. I looked it up.
Oh, he's not?
No.
Shit.
No, we both spent the whole movie thinking he was the crude, foul-mouthed friend from The Girl Next Door. Not Paul Dano, but the one that actually was into porn. And it turns out, even though he looks and sounds just like that
exactly
kid,
like that dude.
Not that kid at all.
Miles Teller was in Footloose.
He was in Footloose, so, you know, you've got that going on.
Thing.
And also Project X.
And he was
also Project X. To be fair, the cast of Project X is big enough that I'm pretty sure everyone from that age group.
Yeah, anybody that's an actor between 17 and 25.
What's
going to
be horrible is I'm going to look that movie up and realize he was like one of the main characters, and I'm going to feel like a... No, he wasn't. Cool. Awesome. Woo! Dodged a bullet there. But I think this movie's a lot of fun. I think if you're not too Murtaugh about it, I think you'll probably enjoy it. And, yeah, I don't know. It's not a great movie. It's not even a movie that would stand out.
No, it's certainly not a great film. And, I mean, we have a fundamental difference with Chris in that we think they're nicer guys than Chris does. And so that allows us to enjoy the film more.
I thought
than
the girl
did.
Was hot. I'll give you that.
Oh, that's Millicent Gergich from Parks and Recreation.
Her name is not so hot, but she's a hot chick.
Well, no, that's a character name on Parks and Rec.
You know, anybody who's extremely homophobic might want to skip this one.
Oh, yeah.
But the funnier scenes were, in fact, those scenes.
Yeah, I thought that scene was hilarious.
I don't know. I just didn't really care for it. I didn't hate it or anything. It was just, eh.
That's okay, Chris. I think we've already established why you're wrong.
I had to go back and reread the plot synopsis just to be familiar with what happened, and I think I saw it 4 months ago. I was like, totally forgot about everything that happened in this movie. But, man, talking to you guys about this, I feel like I'm trapped on an exploding toilet.
No, really. I honestly think our opinions come down to just, you know, the way we were more able to empathize with the characters than you were.
Yeah, you might be right. Also that it's not funny.
Well, we are 21 and over that one, so why don't we talk about... Oh, I'm really excited. Newsroom, season one.
Yes.
Hell yes.
And it's weird to me... The amount of criticism that this has gotten.
It seems like everybody hates this show.
A lot of people do. And the funny thing is, when I watch this, I'm like going, I'm sorry, this is largely the same quality as The West Wing.
Waiting, like, because of all that criticism, I was waiting for that point. I was like, when is it?
Well, I don't know if you finished it, but I only got to episode 6. And I thought, I think the pilot is amazing.
Like, oh my God, yeah. So good.
Knock it out of the park, home run. Amazing Aaron Sorkin stuff. And I do think the second episode dipped just a little bit, but I thought the third episode and the fourth and the
fifth,
whole
rest of the show from there was right on top.
And it was such a slight blip in two that it was, so I was almost like, man, are people talking about episode two? Like, are they upset that it dipped a little in two? Because by three and four and five, I'm like, this is right back on track and doing everything that I love in an Aaron Sorkin story.
And yeah, that's the thing, is it's such an Aaron Sorkin story. And if you already know you don't like Aaron Sorkin, well, this isn't going to change your mind, quite
nobody,
frankly.
But nobody writes pilots better than Aaron Sorkin.
And nobody writes dialogue sometimes better than Aaron Sorkin. Yeah. This guy, like, I have to rewind stuff just because what the actual words were he wrote raised the hairs on the back of my neck.
My favorite line.
How incredibly well written they were.
My favorite line still by far is when he says, so when you ask me why America's the greatest country in the world, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about.
Man,
and he says that
fantastic.
To like an idealistic college student who's like, why is America the greatest country in the world? And he's like, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about.
Huge spiel about why it's not, and it's perfect.
Yosemite?
And the story here, this HBO show follows Jeff Daniels, who plays Will McAvoy, who's the anchor of a major cable news show called Newsnight, imaginary one, of course. And he's always been kind of like, I don't talk about what I actually believe in. I won't even tell anybody about what my designation is of like Republican or Democrat. But one time when he's on a like a college, you know, seminar, sort of like a live panel thing, he breaks and goes into the most amazing speech that you've heard on television possibly ever.
Yeah,
and describes what he
definitely up there.
What's wrong with America? You know, why he's a patriot and why America's fucked up. And it launches into this new show he's been sort of just like a good-looking anchor for a long time who's well-spoken, into taking a brand new direction underneath the aegis of both his producer, who is played by, or the station manager is played by Sam Watterson, and his new producer, played by Emily Mortimer, who has an old relationship with him. They used to be a fling. She cheated on him. They are very uncomfortable working together, but they're both on fire when they are working together.
Yeah, it's incredible.
And so they redirect this with the idea of, like, what if the news tried to be what the news used to be.
Right.
And so this is the same fantasy world as The West Wing, where it's like a president who really does want to be the best man he can and do everything right.
It's an idealistic take on journalism is what it is.
And yeah, even Sorkin admits, yes, this is a fantasy. There's no question. I'm not trying to say that this is what's really happening at news stations. Of course I'm not. I'm saying I think a lot of people wish this is what was really happening at news stations.
I think he's subversively lamenting the fact that this is not what happens. I mean, the problem with the media right now is that everybody's got an affiliation.
Yeah.
And everybody's got an agenda in the way that they present the news, and they'll point it one way or the other. And it's like, what happened to the days of people like Cronkite and Murrow?
Well, I love the fact that they're going, like, a lot of the criticism from the right, or even the mildly right here, is like, even though Jeff Daniels in the show describes himself as a moderate Republican, and it's clear he's a flaming liberal. And I'm like, no, he's not. He's obviously a moderate Republican. It's just compared to Republicans today, that looks like a flaming liberal.
You know? Which is a sad state of affairs when you really think about it.
Yeah, I mean, he's trying to bring things back towards the middle, which they've swung to, you know, too far in a direction. This also has a great supporting cast from John Gallagher Jr., Allison Pill, Thomas Sadowski, Dev Patel, who I usually don't like, but I think is actually
well-used here.
And Olivia Munn, who doesn't come in until about halfway through the season, but once she does, they start really building her character well. And
doing she's surprisingly really good on this show.
Yeah.
Olivia Munn, who I hate on almost everything.
Yeah. Whose name used to make me spit.
And she has a solid arc here where they do super interesting things with her. This was a season that I couldn't put it down. I started watching it, stayed up till like 6 in the morning watching it, went to bed, woke up 4 hours later, put it back on, and just
it's really good.
This is one of the best new shows on TV, in my opinion.
I agree. And like I said, there's a lot of people who would argue otherwise, but I think every single thing they say against it are like, either like, well, yeah, it is a fantasy, or no, you're the one who's crazy.
Right, like, I feel like the two biggest arguments are, you know, the way that it kind of tries to play with history, and it's like, there's no way for it to be a fantasy show about the news if it can't rewrite events that have already happened. Like, there's no way for it to attack, like, I guess I don't understand that criticism of, like, rewriting historical events, like, because it starts with, like, the BP oil spill.
Yeah.
And, you know, it does their own take on it, but, I mean, the facts of the story are still the same.
Exactly. Yeah. They're not changing the facts. And what they're doing is they're presenting a world where, what if the media had held the people who should have been held accountable?
And I, you know, I mean, the biggest accusation here from people say they don't like it. Well, there's two. First off, one is that, but Jeff Daniels is so unlikable. He's such a jerk. I'm like, this bullshit. Series is about the salvation of a jerk. That's kind of the point of it. He's a guy who has just sank down into his base self. Nobody likes him. He's a dick because he forgot who he really was. And it's about the salvation of a soul in a lot of ways, of him starting to find out what's important again in life. And it's a wonderful transformation to watch. And the other accusation is that it's too, quote, preachy.
Yeah, that was the other it's one, like, I was going to mention.
I go, you know what? I fucking hate that shit, because it's like, okay, so we can't have a show that's a fictional show talking about real issues because you're afraid you might hear someone's opinion that differs from
your own. Yeah, I guess I don't understand what people mean by preachy when they talk about that. Like, it's not, I don't feel like it's proselytizing anything. Like, it's just, it's expressing, if it's proselytizing anything, it's proselytizing responsible journalism, and God forbid we...
Yeah, God forbid, Fox News.
The only thing it proselytizes is honoring the facts when you know they're facts.
The truth first. It's an idealistic view of journalism that I think needs to fucking come back. I cry about it. I'm like, oh my God, remember when you could watch the news and just get the facts and the information that you needed?
Well, you probably don't.
I do, actually.
Do you remember that?
But I had to get it
your lifetime?
I had to get it from, like, shitty local access channels.
Oh, fair enough.
You know? And it's just like, man, there's not, again, like I said, there's no Murrows anymore. And that's really what we need.
Well, I think we're all on the same page. I love this show so much. It's fantastic. One of my favorite new shows. It's got 5 commentaries across the first... the 10 episodes. It's got 33 minutes on inside the episodes. Each episode has a 3 to 6 minute featurette, 6 minutes of deleted scenes. The best thing on here is a 26 minute round table with the cast and writers that is funny. It's enlightening. It's just really watching how the process of these characters came together and the things that they were afraid of happening when it was going on. And well, I mean, if there's anything on this you're going to watch it for, or even just own the set for, it's because of this round table setup. And I hope they continue to put those out on future seasons.
This is without a doubt my pick of the week.
Yeah, no, yeah, me too.
Without even batting, which you will now be able to find on our sidebar a little bit more easily. So even if you don't have time to catch the whole show, you'll know which pick was our pick of the week. And we even give you a way to buy it right there off the site.
And
You totally should, yes.
We're just too nice.
Not only should you buy it because it's a great show and you should own it, but you should buy it because it helps us give you more shows.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of a, you know, if you're into something that we're telling you about, if you really want to buy it, please do consider clicking on one of the thumbnails we put under the show and buying it through Amazon that way, because that helps support the site. We really, really appreciate that.
Yep.
So moving on from there, I think it's time to talk about the most recent... actually, before we move on from TV, why don't we talk about House of Cards Season 1?
I thought you would go there.
Yeah, and then I almost didn't. It almost came crumbling down around me.
Oh, see, like a House of Cards?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that was
even beer. When I fail. Beer!
House of Cards is an American remake of a BBC series that, in fact... I reviewed the original BBC series on our old show a while back, and I loved it. Like, was passionate about how much fun it was to watch. And I do like political shows, but they also have to have really good writing for them to work for me, which is why I love Sorkin so well. I mean, he could do a show about insurance salesmen and, like, that all takes place at seminars, and if he was writing it, you'd just be fascinated.
I'm sorry, if he's writing it, it can take place in a shoebox.
Yeah.
It's still going to be interesting.
It's just one guy that's normally not very entertaining, you know, like most boring actor out there in a shoebox by himself, but if Aaron Sorkin wrote it, I'll see it.
Yeah, Ryan Reynolds is like, couldn't they have done that for me? That would have been great. Buried by Aaron Sorkin with a cast of 20 somehow. All these dynamic relationships. How does he keep doing this?
All these worms walking by each other.
Walk with me. Crawl with me.
But House of Cards, the original one, is a guy who's in the House of Parliament who is sort of the Tory leader or the whip leader.
The minority whip?
Minority whip? I don't know. I'm not as familiar.
Majority.
Majority whip.
Oh, there he is pointing it where it says it right in front of us.
There were words on the screen.
And that series was definitely like, it's very different from this. I've watched all of this and all of that one. And that one has, I don't know, there's more of a sort of like, well, we know where this is going to end already. So it's kind of moving a lot faster. It's snapping through it. There's not as many supporting characters. This American version, which came out on Netflix, it was one of the 2 or 3 launching original programming shows that they did, stars Kevin Spacey in this role as an American South Democrat from South Carolina. He's the House Majority Whip, and he, after getting passed over by the president he helped put into office, where he's supposed to get Secretary of State because of that, supposed to be the deal. They're like, yeah, we changed our minds, we're going for somebody else. He decides, I'm getting revenge against everybody who had anything to do with this, and I'm going to get real power.
It's Shakespearean in that regard. It's like, okay, I'm tearing the house down.
It is, but even while watching it, I was going, okay, it's clear they have no intention of limiting this to one season at all. And as well, that's helped by the fact, like, they really boost up the other characters in here as being bigger parts. Like, his wife, played by Robin Wright, in the original one, she's barely a character in it. And here, she's got her entire own arc going on. And the relationship between her and Kevin Spacey is so much more complicated. As well as the lawyer here in this one, which is the thing, is he has this sort of ingenue lawyer who's like, or not lawyer, I'm sorry, journalist, who's like, look, just tell me what to do. As long as you're giving me scoops, I'll print whatever you tell me to do. It'll be our little secret relationship, who he eventually ends up having a sexual relationship with, played by Kate Mara here. That relationship is so much more complex. She has so much more depth to her character than the one and the other. That being said, I think I actually enjoyed the original a little bit more because it's so much more sardonic and evil than this one is.
Like, you know, this, I mean, one's not evil enough for me.
Well, that's the thing, is Spacey, he's evil, but like, he gives you enough depth that you can't kind of relish in his evil. Like, the original one, you're like, what's he gonna do now? And this one, Spacey, is like, he's real evil, and you're like, you know, it's that the evil that doesn't always seem evil, that seems more likable and nice most times, and even has likable and nice sides to him. You know, it works. It all works. But there's no question that if you're expecting a remake of that, it's not really. It goes an entirely different direction. And one thing I want to point out in here that freaked me out when I figured this out, the guy who plays Peter, is it Peter in here? The guy who's the sort of like the senator who has alcohol problems.
Oh, that guy, yeah.
Shit, what is his name? God damn it. It's one of the main characters in this. Oh, yeah, Peter Russo, Corey Stoll. Do you know what else he played?
That name sounds familiar. What else did he play?
Well, assuming I'm right here, he was Ernest Hemingway in Midnight in Paris.
No shit.
Yeah.
The one that I thought was Jason Sudeikis the whole time I was watching it.
Well, you watch it, he's bald and skinny and like totally couldn't be more different. I never in a billion years would have guessed it till I saw someone post it on Facebook. And then I was like, bullshit.
And yet he's still speaking in these long run-on sentences. It's weird. Well, I don't know.
True. And he does indeed hunt lions. So now, I did really enjoy this. I thought like the last episode kind of goes out with a whimper on some ways. Like, wow, really? That was the finale? This is another one of those that the penultimate episode was better than the finale.
I didn't get to see the entire season, but I was really intrigued by the Kevin Spacey character maneuvering all these pawns and really like, when you realize that him getting passed over was a betrayal on par with shooting Michael Corleone's father.
Yeah.
Like, I will never forget that shit. And there will be a bloodletting at the end. But on the other hand, I think it was the effect of this show. And I know this is a little bit unfair, but just, you know, to be completely honest, was the effect of the show was lessened for me by having just watched all of Boss.
Yeah.
Because for me, Boss does a lot of the same things, a lot of that same sort of Machiavellian type drama, but did it in a way that I found a little bit more captivating.
See, I was the opposite, really. I like this better than Boss, but not by a giant margin. Mm-hmm. I was like, they're both good shows, but I love Kevin Spacey so much, and when he's got his heart wrapped around a project, he's everything. And here, like I said, while he's not what I expected, he really is just this major presence here. Everything surrounds around him. I was a little disappointed as well, though, that they didn't, like, the original show, so much of it is like fourth wall breaking. Like,
yeah,
you're
I was
being guided
you
by through the whole thing by the guy talking directly to the audience. And here they use it, but so sparingly that it gets to a point that when they do it, you're like, wow, what the fuck? And it kind of takes you out of the story momentarily when they
okay,
do.
Okay, see, that's what I was going to ask you, is if you were taken aback by the narration or whether it worked for you.
Yeah, it's such a steady thing in the original. And here, like I said, it's like they suddenly remember, oh yeah, we do that, and do it like once every couple episodes, you know.
So it's not used as prevalently as it was in the original series.
No, not even okay. Close. But like I said, I did like this. I thought Kate Mara was great in it. I thought Robin Wright was great in it. It's a really good series that's just getting started. I mean, I already got picked up for a second season. I think it's very much worth watching for fans of political dramas and, like, you know, backstabby type stuff. The only real major disappointment here is that, okay, you know, Netflix is what, for just digital, like $6 a month or something like that, $7 a month?
Mm-hmm.
And this Blu-ray set is probably like $35 or something. And there's no extras of any kind.
See, that's bullshit.
Yeah, none. No extras at all.
Why would you even bother?
Even the subtitles on it are shitty. They're like really bad subtitles.
Wow.
Like with a black box around them, and they take up too much of the screen, and they're bright yellow. And
what
you're like, who the fuck programmed this? You watch this on Netflix, and the subtitles look better on there than they do on this.
Yeah, take a note here, Netflix. If you're going to continue to release your own shows and produce your own shows, put a little bit more time and effort into the DVD Blu-ray releases. Otherwise, there is no reason whatsoever. You've created the reason there's no reason to buy the DVDs and Blu-rays.
Agreed.
So, yeah. Let's work on that for next time. Moving on from there, I think this is a great time to talk about the block of Shout Factory releases.
Dun, dun, dun!
Oh my god, I'm so excited.
We like Shout Factory.
And they have done, like, over the last few weeks, the stuff that they've been putting out has been astounding. And glorious. I'm going to start with my favorite of the lot.
I know what it is.
It was close, actually. It was very close, but I am going to go with Life Force.
Oh, I thought you were going to pick Ninja 3.
I'm like, oh, it's a coin toss. I'm going to have to go with Life Force.
Just knowing you, I was like, oh, it's got to be Ninja 3.
And Ninja, that was the first time I'd seen that movie. We'll get to that
me
in
too,
a second.
Me too.
And the reason that Life Force wins out, in my estimation here, is there's just more extras. This thing is bursting with extras. It's incredible. Life Force is a 1985 film directed by Tobe Hooper, who most of you know from Texas Chainsaw Massacre and quote-unquote Poltergeist.
Quote-unquote.
And in this film, which is based on a book called Space Vampires.
Which I have.
Goddamn right it is.
I have that book. I've read it 3 times. Not even kidding.
This sounds like bargain basement drive-in crap.
Drek. Yeah.
I mean, you can't describe this movie without hearing people go, oh, really? That's what it's about? It's about a crew of a shuttle, of a space shuttle, who comes across this derelict spacecraft, and inside are these what look like crystal coffins with naked people in them, and they're like, oh my god, life from other planets, let's take them with us. And wouldn't you know it, they happen to be space vampires.
Yeah, they don't drink blood, though.
No, but they suck your...
Life Force!
Life Force!
Which is admittedly a better name for a film than Space Vampires.
Yeah, it's really
Roger
clear.
If Roger Corman's not making.
Yeah, it's really clear why they didn't go with the original title. But at the same time, as silly as that might sound, it's a really interesting take on the idea of vampirism, because that's essentially what the fear is of vampires. It's not the fear of them taking literally our blood, but sucking away our life.
And they find a whole sort of arc that's like similar to the original, like classic vampire stories, but at the same time, completely different.
Yeah.
It all echoes the way vampires did things, with the process of being drained and then turning into a vampire yourself.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the same, but has some amazing animatronic effects used in it.
Oh, man.
And there's a lot of good visual stuff in here like that. And the best visual thing of all is the head vampire, played by Matilda May, who is largely completely starkers the entire film walking around. I mean, like, full on, you know, in the bush, everything.
Glorious boobs
and
bush.
And she was, at the time, one of the most beautiful women on the planet.
She was a ballet dancer. She wasn't even an actress.
Yeah. And she is, like I said, she's a knockout. And seeing, like, all you have to do, somebody goes, yeah, it's this great movie, it's about space vampires. Like, I don't want to see that. I'm not going to see that. Just press play on a scene with Matilda May, and they'll go, duh, duh.
I remember one of my first jobs was writing for a horror blog, and I did a piece about Life Force, and I had to find a banner image for the movie. It took me about 4 or 5 pages into Google to find one that didn't have nudity in it.
Yeah.
That is how much nudity is in this. Like, I had to find a picture of her, and I was like, naked, 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 naked. Wow. I just kept going. I was like, there's got to be one of her not naked, right?
And the thing is, like, if that was all there was to it, this would just be, like, a campy little B film that's fun to watch, has a hot chick. But it's a lot more than that. It's a fun movie. It's written by Dan O'Bannon, screenplay from Alien. And it actually has some similar, like, stuff to it, too, from Alien, certainly. But, I mean, it's not always the greatest performances in the world in here, but it's got great effects. It's got a really fun story that goes lots of unexpected places. It's got Patrick Stewart being possessed by Matilda May at one point, who makes out with the lead male character.
Yeah.
In the most awkward scene maybe ever in a science fiction film. But
and
just
it's really funny because in the special features they talk about how Patrick Stewart was on, like, Leno or something, and they asked him about, like,
his first on-screen kiss,
and he had to say Steve Railsback from Life Force.
That's awesome.
But, I mean, the effects are a huge draw here, and I'm blanking on the name right now, but one of the effects guys that worked on this is another guy who is just a legend in the industry. And
John Dykstra.
Yeah, John Dykstra. And then James Horner was asked originally to do the score, and then they got Mancini to do it.
Yeah.
Henry fucking Mancini did the score for this movie.
Well, it's just got, you know, a great resume, and like, while it's not the movie they thought they were making, I think, it's still a super fun film. So if you have no taste at all for films with a certain degree of camp and silliness, then don't even watch this. It's
but at
not
the same time,
thing.
Don't expect but, that that's all this is.
Yeah, exactly. This is so much more than just that.
It goes, like, the when it gets toward the end and it's going completely apocalyptic.
Yeah.
Holy
crap. I mean,
crap.
It goes from, like I said, it goes from Alien or 2001 or something to
World War Z.
To World War Z. And a bunch of different stuff in between that's totally different.
World
movies.
War Double D. It's amazing.
Nice.
But yeah, and that's the thing.
Full points!
Yay! Give me a beer. But yeah, that's the thing about most vampire movies is that they're usually, the conflict is solved within a small group of people before the rest of the world knows anything about it. This movie, London, you're fucked.
Yeah.
Sorry about you.
And I believe this version is the first version on DVD in America that is the full international cut.
That's correct. Before Columbia cut it down for theaters.
Yeah, this is like 13 minutes longer. So if you love this movie already, this is the one to get.
Yeah.
And not just because of that, but because there is a fucking shit ton of bonus features on here.
Absolutely. They have not skimped whatsoever.
And they're really great bonus features,
they are.
Too. They're really impressively done. They were done by a third-party company that...
Redshirt.
That Scream Factory contracted to do them, and they look great, and they're well edited, and they're really informative.
They've got great graphics.
Really, really impressive special features on this Blu-ray.
Yeah, we've got a we got everything from interviews with Toby Hooper, Steve Railsback, and Matilda May. We've got original television making of specials, trailers, galleries. Like we said, the long estranged U.S. theatrical cut is here. Once again, Shout has released this with a gorgeous hand-painted cover.
Oh, yeah.
I love the image on the front. But yet, they offer you the option of flipping the artwork over and having the like original DVD cover.
Yep.
I'm like, I don't know why anybody would do that, but the fact that you would give them the option is pretty badass.
These guys keep doing everything that we keep bitching at everybody else for not doing. They do it right without us even having to ask.
No.
That is why we love them.
Indeed. Yes. And moving on from there to Ninja 3, The Domination.
The Domination.
Holy flurking schnit, dude. I love this movie.
How did I never see this film?
I didn't see Ninja 1 and 2. Am I going to be confused?
That's what's great about this movie. You could stick any two movies with the word ninja in the title in front of it, and it would feel just as coherent and connected to those movies as it did to the actual movies it was supposed to be following.
Yeah, assuming that they're movies where ninjas in broad daylight attack people on golf courses.
Why does the ninja even care about some guy wearing a fucking polo shirt and it's amazing.
Well, they got Shokasugi, so it seems like it's
sorta.
Pretty legit to me.
He's not in it very much, but you're right. You can't make a ninja movie in any decade without putting Shokasugi. Even Ninja Assassin from a couple years ago had Shokasugi.
He's
in
the first 15 minutes. He's in the last 15 minutes. He's not in the rest of it except like, you know, a presence. But like, this is ostensibly a sequel to Evil Enter the Ninja and Revenge of the Ninja, although in no detectable way.
That's true.
And what this really is like, much more than that, it's like a sequel to the 80s. Like, they took all the stuff in the 80s and they were like, oh, this is the stuff that was awesome, and they crunch it into this movie. And
they cut it down really fine with a credit card,
yeah,
and put it in nice little rows.
And yeah, exactly. The story follows a female aerobic instructor who spends most of the movie in those sort of like workout knee sock things, you know, that they all wore.
Like, immediately, even if you hadn't told anybody anything else about this movie and it started with that as a description, they'd be like, oh, it was made in the 80s then.
Yeah, you could have called this Jazzercise 3 the Domination, and it would have made as much sense. But she's like this kind of like a, you know, she's a tough chick, whatever. And she's like, she has a job for some reason as a telephone line repairman. And she's, after watching this beginning where this Shokasugi decides to be all ninja and stealthy by in the middle of a wide open golf course to kill a bunch of people. And then, of course, gets himself killed himself by the 5,000 cops who show up.
But how many? The guy was like the Terminator. They kept shooting him at point blank range. They were surrounding him with guns.
He got shot like at least 50 times at point blank.
He looked like Peter Weller at the beginning of RoboCop.
The greatest movie ever
the
made.
The only difference being he seemed like he had a slight cold.
He's like, oh, that kind of hurt. I'm going to get back up. And the cops are like,
Really?
When is that a ninja thing? I don't know. Daredevil would beg to differ.
That's what's great about this movie is it keeps pushing it and pushing it to the point that you're like, there's nothing about this that feels inherently like a ninja movie. And in fact, on the commentary, if you listen to it, the director talks about how they were trying to capture the spirit of Poltergeist.
Well, yeah, that's so blind. Like, you can't miss it when it happens in the film.
It's a ninja basically,
she like she meets this ninja guy as he's dying. He gives her soul sword. The sword's got his soul. The soul starts to possess her. She falls in love with this cop. He starts to suspect something's wrong when people who were all the cops who survived the shooting of the ninja keep dying as if they were killed by ninjas.
Yeah.
Which she is clearly blacking out and becoming... And like, there's a scene... There is the poltergeist scene. There's the exorcist scene is my favorite. They literally tie her up spread-eagled.
Yeah.
And like, she starts making shit fly around the room and talking in a demon voice and everything. You're like, what the fuck movie is this?
And some of these action sequences are just straight up dangerous. Like, yeah. It looks like they didn't think about it at all. They just got a particularly suicidal stuntman and was like, hey, we want to do this. And he's like, okay, I'm good. I'm doing it right now. It's like, no, let us set up the cameras first.
Yeah, there's so many moments in this film that are laugh out loud funny. Some of the worst dialogue you've ever seen in any film, but in the way that, like, there is no way anybody thought that was a line that anyone would actually say out loud. You know?
I mean, what did you guys expect from the director of Breaking 2?
And Ninja 2.
I expected a bit more Boogaloo than this, quite frankly.
That's fair.
No, but, you know,
Ninja Ghost Boogaloo.
It, but that's the thing is, this is the perfect storm. It's one of those films. It's horrible in every way it can be, except that some of the fighting is actually pretty good.
Yeah,
and it all comes together for a movie that's relentlessly entertaining.
Yeah, absolutely. From start to finish, I was like, this is everything that I want to discover when I reach for a random VHS. Like, you know, when you rent them from the store, well, I do, because that's what I do, and I live in Austin where they still rent VHS, is I can grab one, it's like, this cover looks ridiculous, I'm going to put it in and see what it's all about. This is exactly the type of movie
this
I hope that I see.
This is what you hope for, yeah. The last film I think I saw that was like one of those type of like, I'm going to watch these even though there's like maybe a 1% chance any of them are going to be that did this to me was Slumber Party Massacre Part 2, where you're like, oh my God, this is insane! Where are the rest of the films like this? This is one of them.
And despite all of that, despite how schlocky it is, despite how forgotten it is by a lot of people, Shout has taken the time to clean it up and make it look better than it has any right to be. You know, not all of the grain is gone, but it's reduced to the point that you don't feel like the flesh tones are plasticky. They haven't gone the full DNR.
Yeah.
And I like that. Like, they left enough in to remind you that you are watching something that was shot on film, which I'm always a big fan of.
Yeah, there's a lot of things to like in their production of this, except it doesn't have a lot of extra features, which is a shame. But who? What's the name of this artist? Is it Patrick Nagel right there in that picture?
Oh, I don't know.
I can't remember. The guy used to do all the pictures for the story lines on Penthouse, but he was like the quintessential cheesy 80s artist that everybody had their shit hanging in his house. This woman literally has arcade games in her house, like stand-up arcade games. It's like, it's a drinking game for count the ridiculous 80s thing.
And
then die of alcohol poisoning.
And I mean, yeah, there's not a lot of special features. I do think the commentary is funny just because the director and the stunt coordinators are just so sincere about the whole movie.
Yeah.
Even as they're talking about what you're seeing on screen that they produced.
Yeah, this is so well worth it. And this is one that you watch if you want the total tongue-in-cheek but fast-moving, like, silly. This is a movie you watch at a party.
Absolutely. And it makes me hope, and Shout, if you're listening to this, I really hope you'll go back now and release the other ninja movies with Shokasugi.
More ninja!
Because they all deserve a Blu-ray this good.
Agreed.
And finally on the Shout list is The Howling! Pick the wrong week to stop everything I do.
I got a hairball. The funny thing about The Howling is this came out in 1981, I believe, 2 months either after or before An American Werewolf in London.
Oh, Jesus.
By two people who were already friends. Joe Dante directed this one, and
Jonathan Landis
mm-hmm. directed American Werewolf in London. In fact, even the effects guy for American Werewolf in London started off, who ended up winning the Oscar that year.
Stan Winston.
Yeah, Stan Winston.
Yeah, yeah.
Started off working on this, and then had to leave because basically had a better offer from American Werewolf. But he said, hey, this guy is really good, Rob Bottin. You should have him come on and do it. And
Rob
has gone on to win multiple Oscars himself, I believe.
For have you effects. Seen The Thing? Yeah. Remember The Thing? And that's Rob Bottin.
And while The Howling is certainly not as good a film as An American Werewolf in London.
Or The Thing.
It's also another film that is, you know, horror with edges of comedy that endlessly references the canon and history of werewolf films. This actually does it a little more subtly, I thought, than An American Werewolf in London.
Oh, yeah.
But it is funny, and it's got lots of, like, people who are like, look who it is! And there's a lot of fun to be had in this one. Just don't ever watch any of the sequels except for part three, because it's awful.
The Marsupials is a special kind of bad.
It's so nothing to do with this film.
Thank you, Philippe Moore.
Yeah, nothing to do with this film in any way, shape, or form.
No.
But it's Ossie-ploitation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually pretty fun for that. But no, this is, like I said, this is a fun film for what it is.
And one thing I do really appreciate about it, and I think this is a better or worse situation, I think there are people that are going to dislike it for this very reason, is that it's not every other werewolf movie you've ever seen. It doesn't follow the formula by rote. It does some really interesting and weird things that were refreshing in the sense that it was just like, oh, well, this isn't like every other werewolf movie I've ever seen. So
yeah, no, it does do that. And in fact, one thing you'll note when it finally gets to the point where we see the transformation, it's pretty much on par with American Werewolf in London's werewolf
it's
transformation,
great.
Which is still the greatest one ever on
yeah.
film. But I was like waiting for it to be disappointing, and then you're like, oh, wow, this is terrific.
Funny what happens when you hire Rob Bottin.
Yeah, but yeah, so much fun stuff that happens in here. The story follows Dee Wallace, plays Karen White, who's a newspaper anchor, or not newspaper, LA television news anchor, who has, in the beginning, there's a serial killer stalking her, but she has decided that she's going to try and go along with this guy who keeps contacting her in order to help the police set it up. And we sort of see that he's not quite human, but in shadow, as he's shot to death.
Mm.
But she gets away, but she's so stressed out, her psychologist says, look, you and your husband, I have this colony of people that's sort of like, you know, a place you go and everyone can talk about their problems together. Come out here with us, spend the week here, and I think it'll help you get over your problems.
Werewolf beach party!
Werewolf beach party is exactly what's going on. You don't have to... I'm sorry, while that's a spoiler, what are you, stupid?
Why else would they all be there?
You can't... I mean, like, right off the bat, they're all, like, doing, like, things that traditionally people werewolves when they're human always do. I mean, there's a chick with wearing bones around her neck who's like a total nymphomaniac, you know? You're like, okay.
And you got John Barrymore, who was old even in 1981,
yeah,
running around going, I wish I would die, I can't take it anymore. And I was like, is this just you saying that, or what is that about?
Well, there's lots of fun stuff here. Dennis Dugan has a role in here as well, who, by the way, is, I believe, isn't it Adam Sandler's main co-writer?
Dennis Dugan is?
Yeah, I want to say he's like the guy who's worked on a lot of Adam Sandler's films as a producer. And
You're right. Absolutely. He directed Happy Gilmore.
Big Daddy. I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry. You Don't Mess with a Zohan. Grown Ups, Just Go With It. Jack and Jill and Grown Ups 2.
And we will be providing his address after the show so you can send him hate mail.
But he, as an actor...
I like Happy Gilmore.
As an actor... Yeah, I do too, actually. As an actor, he's rather entertaining, though, I think. This is a fun movie. It's not a classic. It's no American Werewolf in London, but damn it, it is worth seeing. And the end, the last 20 minutes of this are great.
Yeah,
that's where it goes like, all right, you want to see a werewolf movie? Like, when I used to joke around with friends at restaurants, we'd all get drunk late at night and go, I'd say something along the lines of, wouldn't it be cool if a bunch of werewolves attacked you right now? You know what I'd do?
What was it like to hang out with young Chris?
You know what I'd do? I'd grab that shit off the bar right there and be like, welcome to the Winchester, bitches!
Awesome.
I mean, this is Joe Dante post-Piranha, but pre-Gremlins. I think that, in and of itself, is worth the price of admission.
Yeah, no, this is, like I said, it's a lot of fun for what it is. Now, this is Shout Factory, once again, so it actually looks... You know, they give so much attention a lot of time to films that don't deserve it at all to mix up. And you're like, really? This is the film you're going to do? But like this, I'm glad they did. Great video, great audio on here, and a decent amount of extras.
It's pretty bursting with extra stuff. And I will say this about the transfer specifically, is that there's a lot of scenes in this movie that are supposed to be dreamlike. So Dante's cinematographer shot them in really soft lighting.
Yeah.
And that can really be a beast when you're doing a high-def transfer.
A beast.
Ah, good. Because soft lighting tends to make things fuzzier. But I was really impressed. I'm not even trying anymore to make it. But I was impressed.
He is. He
I was
always
impressed.
Is.
Werewolf.
Beer. I was impressed all the way through by the fact that even though there was a lot of soft lighting, it still looked really good.
Yeah. Like I said, there's a lot of stuff on... There's a thing on the sequels, which are very, very silly. Stuff about the writing, the special effects, the locations. I mean, they really did their best to try and do as many new featurettes as they can.
They talked to anybody involved with this movie. Like, yeah. What do you got to say? Tell us about
some guy walking by on the street when somebody...
Like, hey, did you see the Howling?
Yes.
A special interview with a guy who was alive and saw it when it came out. What's up? Yeah, it was good. We were fucked up. Another
oh, a theater? No, I saw it on VHS, dog.
A dog?
I don't know.
Well, that brings us to the end of not this week's episode of Digital Noise. Almost got me.
Yep, almost owed me a shot there.
I almost did. But of, you know, the first part of it. Because quite frankly, some weeks are just going to be long and we'll be having too much fun and there's too much booze flowing. And we're like, fuck it, why don't we just give you a second episode a couple days later? Because who the hell's got time to listen to a 3-hour podcast?
Why give you one episode when we can give you two?
Right, which is, of course, not going to be every week, but this week it is indeed. So in a couple days after this, you'll see the, you know, basically part two of this week's episode go up. Check that shit out.
Yeah, absolutely. And before we go, I do want to say, remind you all that you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/oneofusnet. You can also follow this show specifically on Twitter, @DigiNoiseCast. You can follow us individually. Luke is @LDMullen. I am @BryGuySalisbury. And Chris is...
I need to start a new Twitter address.
Chris is going to start a new Twitter address, so just ignore that completely. And make sure that if you like the products we're talking about and you're considering purchasing them, please consider purchasing them through our links, because again, that does support the site. We really appreciate it. That's how we can keep giving you guys content on a regular basis.
Yeah, go to, if you're listening to this on iTunes or some other source, go to the actual page itself on oneofus.net that we have up for the landing page, and it'll have, you know, we'll have it in, organized by the picture of the title, so you can actually see what the cover looks like, the time we talk about it on here, and if you click on it, it'll bring you to Amazon where you can buy it directly. Please do that.
We would really, really appreciate that. And also, I want to say a special, before we go, I do want to say a special thank you for all those who donated to the fundraiser to help not only myself, but Jason and Jeff kind of stabilize a little bit in the transition period. That is the reason, I will tell you guys straight up, because of your generosity, that we were able to have that time to develop this site and get it ready. And I can't say thank you enough. So really, from the bottom of my heart, guys, thank you so much for your generosity. I hope you'll continue to listen to Digital Noise. We've got a lot of great stuff we're going to bring your way, and we're really excited about this whole project, and we hope you guys are too.
Plus, it's the reason why we were able to afford 5 strippers to the party instead of just one.
Yeah, because if it's just one, then it's like, who's
it's
on first?
Lonely and kind of like pathetic.
No, but not Abbott and Costello, like who's on her first?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's going to do it for this, the first part of this inaugural episode of Digital Noise. And until next time, what I'm going to tell you, you're going to need a bigger remote.